This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're listening to Percy Faith, theme from A Summer Place, the number one song for all of March 1960, which, as we'll hear, is a key date in our next conversation. The early 1960s were a time of transition in America, especially in higher education, when universities were preparing for what some called a tidal wave of baby boomers that would be flooding onto campus in the years ahead, and also reckoning with growing calls for more freedom on campus, especially among young women. This time is the subject of a new book by our next guest, Matthew Ehrlich. It's called Dangerous Ideas on Campus: Sex, Conspiracy, and Academic Freedom in the Age of JFK. In it, he looks at two free speech cases from the University of Illinois in the 1960s and how they still resonate today when universities remain a central front in the so-called culture wars. Ehrlich is an emeritus professor of journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and he joins us now. Matthew Ehrlich, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Maybe you went to a university in the 1960s, in this era we're going to be talking about. You want to share some of your memories on campus? Maybe some of what we talk about will resonate with you today about what life was like. We'd love to hear about it. Or maybe you're a college student today, and all this just sounds kind of crazy and archaic to you. We'd love to hear your perspective as well. 800-222-9455 is the number to call, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. So let's talk a little bit about the University of Illinois at the mid-century. What would it have been like on campus at that time?
Well, it was very different from what it is today in a lot of respects. For example, the composition of the undergraduate student body, it was 70% male and 30% female. So the numbers obviously have changed quite a bit in terms of many more women being enrolled today than they were back then. One thing that perhaps has not changed so much is that the U of I was considered the fraternity capital of America back in 1960, and Greek life, as far as I know, is still very important to a lot of undergraduates today. But the social mores, particularly regarding sex, were very different. The doctrine of what's been called in loco parentis, or in the place of a parent, was very much the norm in higher education and at the University of Illinois. There were things like the three-foot rule. So if you were a male-female couple on campus meeting in a dormitory lounge, for example, you had to have three of your 4 feet on the ground at all times. So those kinds of restrictions are obviously something that, if you're a college student today, certainly sound quaint, but they had real force back 60 years ago.
Yeah, you say in loco parentis usually took the form of one word, which is don't. And in 1960, I mean, people think of the 60s and they think of baby boomers, but at this point, it's still the silent generation on campus, right? Can you talk about them?
Yeah, the silent generation is a term that's typically applied roughly from people who were born about from the onset of the Great Depression in 1929 through the end of World War II in 1945. And like any sweeping generalization about any generation, silent is really misleading. Everyone from Martin Luther King to Abby Hoffman was born during that time period. People who have studied the silent generation, so-called silent generation, have pointed out that a lot of what boomers are either credited or blamed for, you know, the sexual revolution, for example, or the civil rights movement and the seeds of the anti-war movement, all of those were being planted really prior to the arrival of the first wave of baby boomers. About 1964 is when that happened. But yeah, there was some truth to the stereotypical view of the silent generation as being generally, you know, I guess you could refer to them as quote unquote good kids. They were basically studious. They were basically, happy with their place in society. Generally convinced that if they did their studies and did their work, that they would find a prosperous place in American society. Again, that's kind of the stereotypical view of the silent generation, overlooking the fact that there was already a certain degree of questioning and dissent that's always existed among young people and among that generation in particular. But there is at least some truth to the popular conceptions of what the silent generation was all about.
And in that, and we'll get to the centerpiece before we do, though, of the two sort of free speech cases. But just, you mentioned the sort of sexual mores of, and maybe mores is not the right term, but right, this idea that the universities were in loco parentis, the 3-foot rule, they're telling students don't. But there is a sort of negotiation that goes on, and maybe more sexual activity than people would admit to. Although with constraints and still with real social consequences if people, went too far and a pregnancy resulted, for example, right?
Yeah, I'm going by the memories of people like Roger Ebert, who was an undergraduate during this time period and wrote about it in his memoirs. Actually, before he wrote about it in his memoirs, he did a blog post where he titled it "Making Out is Its Own Reward," which I thought was actually kind of revealing. It's the idea that, yeah, it was constrained, that you could do stuff up to the point of actual intercourse. Intercourse itself was relatively verboten, although of course young people were having sex because young people have always had sex. But you were still theoretically allowed to do other things have kind of been popularly remembered as petting, so-called petting, and so-called heavy petting. And so that kind of thing was allowable. At the same time, there was still a very strong stigma attached to premarital sex, to actual intercourse. And there was a great deal of ignorance about things like contraception, even though the oral contraceptive pill was introduced in 1960, and even though other forms of contraception were available. So the students who, despite the stigma about sex, were in fact engaging in intercourse, a lot of unplanned pregnancies did in fact occur. There was a lot of confusion, a lot of frustration, a lot of guilt. And that was kind of the background to how the whole Leo Cook case, which is one of the two cases at the heart of the book, erupted.
Yeah, and let me just remind listeners, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Matthew Ehrlich, who's an emeritus professor of journalism at the U of I Urbana-Champaign and the author of Dangerous Ideas on Campus, Sex, Conspiracy, and Academic Freedom in the Age of JFK. And if the 21st show sounds a little more prurient than usual today, we do have a purpose. And we are, as you just said, building up to this case of Leo Cook, which is one of the two big free speech cases that you document. So who was Leo Cook?
Leo Cook was a biology professor who had come to the University of Illinois after two short stints at other universities that ended as near as the historical record shows and Cook's own recollections show, he kind of left in a huff where he left over differences between himself and the administration. Regardless, the U of I hired him in something that was called the Division of General Studies to teach essentially introduction to biology classes. And in addition to teaching those classes, he also was a dedicated he called himself a scientific humanist and was very suspicious of organized religion and organized religion's impact on social ethics. So during his years at the University of Illinois, which started in the mid-1950s, He frequently wrote letters to the editor talking about Christianity, saying deliberately provocative things. He advised the campus humanist society. He showed up at political when you know, folks like Senator Paul Douglas from Illinois showed up on campus. Leo Cook would be in the audience and kind of ask very pointed questions about why Red China was not being admitted into the United Nations. So basically, Leo Cook was, in addition to being a teacher, he was a gadfly. He was the kind of person who was always popping up in the media, always popping up on campus, and being deliberately provocative and speaking very in a very impassioned manner about what was important to him.
And sometimes this, I mean, this sometimes this led to a sort of troubled relationships with his departmental colleagues. He was on his way out the door. He was not going to renew his teaching contract. And this is when he decides, he sees something in the Daily Illini and decides to write a letter to the editor, right? What was that all about?
So two male undergraduates wrote a guest column for the Daily Illini paper in March of 1960. And they were basically, the column was headlined somewhat misleadingly, Sex Ritualized. But the two students weren't really writing about sex per se. What they were writing about was a very restrictive and very kind of calcified, if that's the right word, campus dating culture. And the example they used was couples making out in a sorority lounge late on a Saturday night, and how these couples were kind of obligated to continue making out till the 1 o'clock curfew for women. That was another kind of relic of that era, is that women had different regulations from men, and women had curfew hours, whereas a lot of times men did not, or curfew hours for men, if they did exist, were much less restrictive. So the two students were sort of saying, like, this whole ritual of lining up a Saturday night date and then going to the lounge at the end of the evening and kind of being obligated to make out until 1 o'clock to sit smooching, you know, this fairly innocent smooching, just kind of showed that people weren't really recognizing each other fully as human beings. So they were really writing about gender relationships and how they thought that gender relationships should be renegotiated in a more equitable way, in a way that allowed college students to see themselves more fully. So it was a pretty tame column, but Leo Cook read this column and decided that the students had missed the point entirely. For him, the real problem was the restrictions on sexual intercourse. And he wrote a letter to the Daily Illini and said, in effect, you know, there should be no restrictions on young people engaging in intercourse if it's in line with their ethical code and if they, you know, pay attention to things like contraception. And in this, if we condone this, do not restrict it, it's actually going to lead to healthier, more long-lasting marriages. He wasn't even talking about so-called casual sex. He was talking about basically what Kinsey had already written about several years earlier, which is that restrictions on sexuality and ignorance about sexuality lead to really problematic relationships and problematic marriages. And this happened to be published in the Daily Illini. It's kind of a perfect storm of timing. The exact same day that thousands of high schoolers and their families from across the state were showing up in Champaign-Urbana for the state high school basketball tournament. So the guy who was the editor, the DI at that time, would recall that, you know, the newspaper was published early in the morning, and by noon you could no longer find it on campus. The copies that were still available, the column had been ripped out of the paper, and it turned into a giant public relations nightmare for the University of Illinois.
Well, so what happens to Cook then? How did the university and the public respond to the letter?
Well, there were a variety of responses. You know, not everybody objected to the letter. In fact, the public response in some ways was restricted just to the letters to the editor column of the Daily Illini for the first couple of weeks after this was published. And there were pro letters and there were con letters, kind of typical. But at the same time, there was a former communist turned Baptist minister and arch conservative in the Chicago area named Ira Latimer, who decided that this was proof that a massive communist conspiracy was threatening to take over the University of Illinois. And he organized a letter writing campaign, sent a 3-page single-spaced letter to, with the help of some allies, to the parents of female students, saying this is what's, with the reprint of Cook's letter, saying this is what is wrong with your campus. And you who are receiving my urgent notice about this horrible thing taking place on campus, write to the president of the University of Illinois, write to your state lawmakers. And these letters started to arrive at the in the president's office at the University of Illinois. Even before that, though, a couple of trustees of the University of Illinois, right after Cook's letter had been published, they themselves wrote to President David Dodds Henry, saying, you know, we are genuinely offended. This is not the kind of thing that should be expressed in a letter to the student newspaper, and that's going to be read by impressionable young people, yeah, let alone high schoolers. And so they had already gotten kind of the wheels turning to get Leo Cook removed from the classroom, which in fact happened about 2 or 3 weeks after the letter was published. Yeah. He was put on leave, relieved of his duties, and then at the end of the academic year, he was fired.
And one little fun fact for people who are familiar with Illini sports, Red Grange on the board of trustees at the time, part of the group ousting him. We need to take a break. We're going to continue our conversation with Matthew Ehrlich on his new book, which is called Dangerous Ideas on Campus, Sex, Conspiracy, and Academic Freedom in the Age of JFK. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are speaking with Matthew Ehrlich, who is an emeritus professor of journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and author of the new book, Dangerous Ideas on Campus, Sex, Conspiracy, and Academic Freedom in the Age of JFK. 800-222-9455 is the number if you want to join our conversation, if you have a question for our guest or maybe a memory of going to a university back in the 1960s, what that was like. Have you ever been subject to the 3-foot rule we heard about, a man and woman together in a dorm lounge, say, 3 feet have to remain on the floor? 800-222-9455 is the number. Before the break, we heard one of the two key figures in the book is was a professor named Leo Cook, who was fired for writing a letter to the Daily Illini that basically argued for a version of sexual liberation that was maybe a few years too early for how it was received. And before we move on to the other major figure in your book, maybe we can talk about then some of the changes that happened on campus in the early 1960s. And you have as a key moment a visit of presidential candidate John F. Kennedy to the U of I's campus on October 24th, 1960. We have a little clip from that speech.
I come to this university, which is a center of knowledge, which is a center of truth. And you cannot possibly tell me in 1960 that the American people are going to choose to sit still and give power and responsibility to those who in the last 8 years have demonstrated an unawareness of the basic nature of our times.
You write that Kennedy's visit caused a real sensation on campus, right? 10,000 people came to see him, some of them climbing trees. The Daily Illini's campus scout columnist quoted a woman saying, "He's so handsome, it's a shame to waste such a hunk of a man on a job that will age him," which, let me say, as someone who has also appeared in a campus scout column, that's a pretty good way to come off, but I digress. You quote Kennedy quoting Lincoln 100 years earlier, "I see the storm coming, and his hand is in it," referring to God, "but if he has a place and a part for me, I believe that I am ready." Kennedy also saw the storm coming. What was he talking about?
Well, he was talking about the fact that as he campaigned in 1960, that and said in his inaugural address that it was time for the torch to be passed to a new generation. And he was really appealing to the college generation to join him in that quest. And he turned out to be prescient in actually seeing a storm coming, because 1960 was the time that the sit-in demonstrations were starting at lunch counters in the South, and the civil rights movement started to really exert a profound influence over white college students, as well as African-American college students and students of color. It was the time of the Cold War. A couple of years later, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, and students and everyone else at the U of I were scared to death, just as everyone was across the country and across much of the world. And so pacifism was very much in the news. Kennedy founded the Peace Corps, and a lot of students became involved in the Peace Corps. And by the time of 1963, you're into the March on Washington, the bombing of the church in Birmingham, Alabama, and the fire hoses being turned on civil rights protesters in Birmingham. So it really was a stormy time, just as Kennedy had forecast.
And so you mentioned 1963, which is a good transition to November of that year and the assassination of Kennedy. And that's also the catalyst for the next major episode in your book. There was a faculty member named Revelo Oliver who had, he was, I guess you'd say today, an arch conservative, right? Or beyond even. He had been, joined the staff of National Review. He was part of anti-fluoridation campaigns, not wanting fluoride in the water in Illinois. He helped found the John Birch Society. What did he have to say about the Kennedy assassination?
Well, I think it's fair to say that he was not a big fan of President Kennedy and not a big fan of the Democratic Party generally, and of quite a few politicians of that era. And, you know, what he said, this was in a piece published by the John Birch Society magazine, American Opinion. The very basic argument was that a conspiracy was behind the assassination, and the Warren Commission would likely whitewash the details. So it's important to acknowledge at least that fact, that today, at least that basic argument is not all that controversial. Lots of people think that a conspiracy was behind the JFK assassination, and a lot of people have at best mixed views, if not negative views, toward John F. Kennedy. But in February 1964, when this is published, it was only weeks after Kennedy was assassinated. And Oliver went beyond just saying a conspiracy was behind the assassination. He said, in effect, Kennedy was a communist, Kennedy was an evil person, and the reason he got liquidated was that the people he was collaborating with decided he had outlived their usefulness to him and decided that liquidating him would set the stage for a full communist takeover. So this caused another public uproar, with people saying this is completely ridiculous. This is beyond the pale for a respected professor of the classics to be saying such nonsense about a person that a lot of people saw as a martyr. And there were other things. Oliver had already been the focus of controversy because he had said lots of bad things about liberals in general, basically equating them to communists. But he also was becoming increasingly overtly racist and anti-Semitic. And although that was not the immediate trigger for the uproar that emerged with his Kennedy piece, that was part of the background and part of the reason that people were so concerned about him.
Yeah, and you have, and yet, I should say, and yet he was treated quite differently than Professor Cook had been a few years before. Young Roger Ebert, again, figures into your story here. He was editor of the Daily Illini at this point, and he condemned Oliver's comments, but defended his right to make them at least. What ultimately happens to Oliver then?
Basically, the Board of Trustees decides that it's not going to sanction Oliver at all. President Henry had consulted with the Academic Freedom Committee on campus, which is something he did not do when Leo Cook was fired. It's important also to point out that Oliver held tenure. He was a full professor of the classics. He had already been on campus many, many years, whereas Leo Cook was kind of the equivalent of what would today be called contingent faculty. In fact, Leo Cook was already on a terminal contract, meaning that he was going to be let go anyway. But Oliver already had much fuller protection. But also what had happened in the 4 years separating the two cases, 1964, when Revelo-Oliver's controversy erupted, was that the university had been censured by the American Association of University Professors in response to the Leo Cook firing. And the university was trying to revise its statutes and basically trying to really put on a better public face in terms of its academic freedom protections in order to get that AAUP censure removed. So Revelo-Oliver benefited from that as well.
So the professor preaching sexual liberation gets fired. There's a response from this academic group, and the one who is racist and anti-Semitic benefits, I guess, because he is able to hold on to his job. Let's go now to the phones at 800-222-9455. Kay is calling in from Champaign. Kay, thank you for calling in.
Hi. I was on campus in the late 60s, and I heard you talking about the 3 feet on the floor rule.
Sure.
And it brought back memories because I was president of a dorm, and it was my job to go around and make sure that was the case, and that was not a fun job, I'll tell you.
I can imagine.
And, yeah, and we also were the last dorm on campus. This was Lincoln Avenue Residence. It was all female then. We were the last dorm on campus to require dresses or skirts at dinner.
Oh, wow.
And many of us had zip-up jumpers that you could put on in about 10 seconds. And also, I wanted to point out that at that time, the Vietnam War was a real issue, and grades became a life and death issue because guys, if they didn't make grades, they were going to go to Vietnam. So
wow.
That put stress on everybody.
Did you feel those rules, like the 3-foot rule, did that change during your time on campus? Is that something that felt a little more relaxed over the years or no?
No, it was.
No.
I graduated in 69, and I was a student senator after I was president of the dorm. And things like that came up in student senate, amazingly. But it was still. And the hours, women had to be in at 10:30 on weekdays, as I recall, and 11 o'clock, I think, on weekends, except once in a while there'd be a free night on a special night on a weekend, and then they could stay out until midnight.
Oh,
and
wow.
what I think administrators didn't realize was that a lot of women just stayed out all night because you'd get late minutes.
Oh,
and
right.
If you accumulated 10 late minutes, you had to go before governing board and do something. I don't know, sweep the hall or something.
Oh, my
know.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Well, Kay, thank you so much for sharing your memories. We really appreciate that.
Yeah,
sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, we're coming to the end of our time here. You relate I think one of the reasons you wrote this book is that some of these ideas of free speech and academic freedom on campus, they're obviously still very much in the news now. And, you know, I think that the way those letters were received at the time would be quite different from how they would be received today. And yet, you know, the episodes that you document do speak today. Maybe you can just relate what happened then to how we talk about these, you know, culture war issues of free speech on campus today.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, sex is still very much an issue. We have concerns about sexual consent and about so-called rape culture and so-called hookup culture on campus. Sex as a public issue and as sex is something that should be discussed seriously on college campuses is still very much a concern. White supremacy is still very much a concern, obviously. And so these issues, even though in some ways they seem very dated and seem very quaint, you know, in loco parentis, what is really the university's responsibility for individual students' well-being? So some people have said, rightly or wrongly, that we're in kind of a new age of in loco parentis, of a very different sort from the 3-foot rule of days gone by, but it's still a concern. And then there's just the broader concern of the importance of the university being a place of free exchange of ideas. And it's also important to remember that there is a distinction between free speech and academic freedom. The way that one person has described it is free speech is a democratic value, whereas academic freedom is a meritocratic value. And on academic campuses, you know, you were just talking about ivermectin. It's kind of like, what is peer reviewed? What has actually been tested among people with some expertise in the subject? That's really what academic freedom is about in trying to protect. The fact that faculty members, people who are closest to the subject, really should be the ones who best determine what should be taught, what should be researched. At the same time, free speech more generally among faculty members speaking as citizens and among students and with their free speech rights and among guest speakers who are being brought to campus are still very important. And we should be very cautious about putting restrictions on that kind of speech because it really can open a whole can of worms and really lead to the university not being home to the full exchange of ideas that it really should be.
Matthew Ehrlich is the author of Dangerous Ideas on Campus, Sex, Conspiracy, and Academic Freedom in the Age of JFK. Thank you so much for coming on the 21st Show to talk with us about your book, and congratulations.
Thank you, Brian. I enjoyed it.
That is all the time we have for our program today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're going to be speaking with Governor Pritzker later this week. We'd love to have your questions for him. Get in touch with us at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.